From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! President Bush rolls back more environmental protections. Today we'll look at arsenic and old growth. Then we go to Vermont's death row, to the sheep, to the threat of foot and mouth disease around the world, and betrayal of trust, the collapse of public health. We'll have a conversation with Lori Garrett. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The New York Daily News is reporting that police brutality victim Abner Louima has reached a tentative settlement of his civil suit that will make the Haitian immigrant a rich man, but derail his bid to smash the blue wall of silence. Louima, whose torture in the bathroom of a Brooklyn police station house in 1997 grabbed international headlines, would get $9 million under the proposed deal with New York City and the Patrolman's Benevolent Association. The breakthrough in months of talks came when Louima gave up his bid to reform the way the New York Police Department deals with rogue cops, including his demand to scrap the so-called 48-hour rule, which allows officers under suspicion to avoid police questioning for 2 days. And moving to another case, this one in Lima, Peru, accused of being an MRTA leader in 1995, Lori Berenson is prepared to tell her side of the story for the first time in an open courtroom. Berenson confidently declared her innocence during the trial's opening session Tuesday, in which prosecutors spent 3 hours outlining evidence they say implicates the 31-year-old New York native in, quote, terrorist collaboration. New evidence introduced Tuesday includes alleged proof that Lori Berenson helped incite prison protests against harsh conditions at the Yanomayo prison, where she and other members of the Tupac Amaru revolutionary movement were being held. Late last night, the WBAI newsroom got in touch with Lori Berenson's father, Mark Berenson, who is watching the trial in Lima.
Lori is innocent. She's been wronged. It's time for the United States State Department to recognize this wrong. It's this outrage. Lori stood up, poised, calm, and collected, and made the statement, I'm behind bars. The presumption should be innocence, and to the world, they think I'm guilty. This is degrading. It's beneath human dignity to have me behind bars. I'm an accused terrorist. I'm not convicted. And the judge lied and said, well, this is the way we do it in Peru, and that's what Reuters reported. Well, that's not true. In certain Peruvian terrorism courts, the person sits in a courtroom. In this particular courtroom, there's no place that they did that so that they put her behind bars in a cage. But in other courtrooms for the same kind of charge, Lori wouldn't be behind bars. It just happened to be this courtroom that they selected because of the size to hold the greatest crowd of international journalists. The State Department just last month in its annual human rights report said that these courts, these special terrorism courts, failed to meet international standards. And because of that, there's no way she can really get a trial here in Peru under these conditions. They're using the same old laws, rules, and regulations developed by the corrupt, disposed government of Alberto Fujimori and Vladimiros Montesinos. The same court personnel, and there's been no judicial reform in these special terrorism courts. To give Lori or anyone else a trial at this time is preposterous. You must reform the system. And so she's falling under the old system, and she's going to be convicted, I think. And it's wrong, because if the people were fair-minded and had reasonable laws, they would see she's innocent, and she shouldn't be convicted. Miguel Vivanco, the executive director of Human Rights Watch America, said their laws are so vague and broad that almost any activity merits conviction. So Lori will do her best, and hopefully fair-minded people will hear her innocence, believe in her, and realize that the charges against her are preposterous, absurd. There's no other way to describe it. This whole thing is a zoo. You'd have to see the papers in New York today. With Lori behind bars, the only thing they didn't throw was a banana at her so she could be the monkey that they put her in a cage. And the journalist, given tremendous freedom, stomping and screaming and for her to turn around and be snapped as if it was in a press conference. It was a zoo, if not circus, atmosphere, and that was said to us by many of the journalists. For Lori to be degraded as a human being behind bars gives the world the impression that you're guilty and that you've got to prove your innocence, where in Peru, as in the United States and around the world, you must be presumed innocent and have the state prove you guilty. But look at the visual of Lori behind bars.
Mark Berenson, the father of Lori Berenson, who is in the midst of a, quote, civilian trial in Lima, Peru. And finally, Mexico's Zapatista rebels yesterday snubbed Mexican President Vicente Fox's call for immediate talks, saying that the government had not yet met its conditions. And in other news from Mexico, Cancun's police chief was fired this week for failing to prevent the violent beatings of protesters at the World Economic Forum last month.
I'll remember.
Tishinahosa Festival of Flowers here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Environmentalists charge that the Bush administration is making concessions to industry at the expense of the environment. The latest move came this week when the Environmental Protection Agency announced it will withdraw a new drinking water regulation approved by the Clinton administration. The rule, which would have reduced by 80% the permissible standard for arsenic in drinking water, had been a priority of environmental groups from more than a decade. But the mining industry and some municipalities complained that lowering allowable levels of the carcinogen would be too expensive. This announcement comes on the heels of another rollback, Bush's decision to use an obscure administrative procedure to allow logging, mining, and drilling on national land, one of the most popular environmental initiatives in decades. Clinton's last-minute roadless area conservation policy would have protected the last 30% of untouched national forest lands. We're joined by several people to talk about this issue. Charlie Kuhn is with us from the Heritage Foundation, Elise Campaign from the NRDC, the Natural Resources Defense Council, and Arjun Makajani is president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. Let's begin with Arjun Makajani on the issue of the rollback of the arsenic rule. Explain what the rule was and now what this means.
Well, the previous rule required arsenic levels to be below 50 micrograms per liter of water. And the new rule requires an 80% reduction, as you said, to 10 micrograms per liter. It was not a last-minute rule. It was published on January 22nd, actually, in the Federal Register. But this is a rule that has been carefully researched and in the making for 4 years. A draft rule was published quite some time back, which was actually proposed to be much more stringent than the final rule. The draft rule was 5 micrograms per liter, and there were extensive public hearings, input from environmentalists, industry, governments, and the final rule that was published in January was twice as relaxed, twice less stringent than the original proposed rule of 5 micrograms per liter.
Charlie, so
more or less the situation. The object was to reduce the number of cancers attributed estimated to be produced by additional carcinogens in the water, arsenic, and also non-quantifiable economic benefits and health benefits from a number of other health effects of arsenic, such as on neurological and endocrine systems.
Charlie Kuhn of the Heritage Foundation, are you concerned about this rollback?
I don't think there's reason to be for concern. I think the issue here is that it's not a rollback. It's a delay, which is consistent with what Congress had requested in the VA HUD independent agency's appropriations for 2001. That was concern among members of Congress as well as the National Academy of Sciences and EPA itself, that all of the data wasn't in, that they still needed to research, to conduct more research and get more scientific data before they could determine what the level of reduction should be. So what the administration is doing is simply taking a hard look at the data. There will be a rule. The issue is not whether there will be a reduction. The issue is what will that reduction be? And the administration, EPA, is going to take time to review the data and make sure that the final rule has the appropriate reduction regarding the risk and the cost of such a reduction.
Arjun Makajani.
Well, there's quite a lot of data available. If we're going to wait for definitive data on carbon dioxide or arsenic or any other environmental thing, then we will have catastrophe upon us already. I mean, this would be, for instance, especially true of carbon dioxide. All of these things are done statistically. There's always going to remain uncertainty, considerable uncertainty, and you have to proceed on the best information available. The best information available is that arsenic at 50 micrograms per level, which is a half-century-old standard, does produce damage. There was extensive study already by the National Academy of Sciences, by the EPA, and there's been extensive economic analysis. The economic analysis shows that the typical cost for a water system serving 1,000 or 2,000 households, 3,000 households, fairly small water systems, would be about $1.50 per person per month, which is the cost of a bottle of water or two. That's the cost that we're talking about. The rollback, these delays will not produce significant new information. These are just gifts to industry. There is financial help available for small municipalities. There were extensive hearings and consideration to the financial situation of small governments. You're never going to have complete consensus. We wait for complete consensus. We won't have any environmental rules.
Charlie Kuhn of the Heritage Foundation, Washington Post yesterday says at least 34 million people in the U.S. are exposed to drinking water supplies with elevated levels of arsenic that occur naturally or as a result of industrial pollution and mining operations. National Academy of Sciences study concluded that arsenic in drinking water can cause cancer of the lungs, bladder, and skin, and that the biggest problems are found in the Southwest, Midwest, and Northeast.
I'm not sure about the Midwest. I was of the impression that the Midwest was not experiencing those problems. Let me just respond in that again. No one is saying that there is not going to be a regulation on arsenic. The issue is what that level of reduction should be. I also would like to comment about the cost. The data that the gentleman just mentioned, the cost differs according to the communities that you talk to. And most of the data that I've seen is considerably higher than $1.50 per person per month. We're talking about, in some cases, $30, $50 a month increase in cost for individuals, and I think that is significant. Because,
what about the health cost?
Pardon me?
The health cost of being exposed to arsenic.
The cost will be driven by what the standard is, and again, the administrator for the EPA has not said, nor has the administration said, that there's not going to be a standard For arsenic, what the administration wants to do is take a look at the data, ensure that we're using sound science before we set a standard. And it's not fair to the public to set a standard without that data. Otherwise, you give individuals a level of comfort which isn't there.
National Academy of Sciences is not the standard that you would accept.
Well, the National Academy of Sciences has not said what the standard should be. They have said, the National Academy of Sciences has said that 50 parts per billion is too high. But they have not said what that standard should be. There's a big difference between 50 and 10. There's a lot of room there. If the prior administration thought that that there wasn't
well, let me
some,
just say,
room to
let
to,
me just say that
at,
the standard
they would have stayed firm with their five.
The standard the Clinton administration used, that Congress mandated the toughening of the standard, would have brought the U.S. into compliance with a standard adopted by the World Health Organization. Elise Campaign of National Resources Defense Council is also with us. Did campaign contributions play any role here, Elise?
I think it's that certainly raises a lot of suspicions. I mean, it is outrageous that people are saying that we need to delay the rule to try to do something that's ostensibly going to protect the public when, again, as you have noted, the National Academy of Sciences has said that we do need to ratchet down the standard as promptly as possible. The levels of the allowable levels currently in place for drinking water are 10,000 times higher than the EPA would allow for arsenic in our food. The Mining Association has given over $5 million just in the last campaign cycle to Republican candidates. Many of these candidates were the same people who put the rider on the VA HUD bill that, again, was seeking to delay the time the EPA had to issue the final rule. However, Congress has been explicit in saying that we need to respond to the clear, definitive scientific advice which has come forward and said that we need to protect the American public. And in the 1996 Safe Drinking Water Act that passed overwhelmingly with bipartisan support, that deadline was to be January 1st, 2000. So what the administrator said in waiting to redo this rule is, we know that 50 parts per billion is unsafe, but we want to give these mining interests and others who have petitioned the agency hard, saying that they think that the cost is too high. They want they're allowing those who pay to play get an extra bite at the apple here, and the American public will suffer. It's also shocking that the cost issues are under debate. Industry repeatedly overstates the cost of any kind of public health and environmental regulations. And EPA found that, you know, as far as 3 parts per billion is feasible, when the Republicans have put forward their tax cut and are proposing where they want to spend their money, spending money to help small rural systems deal with this public health threat should be a real priority and would go a long way to protecting the public from the devastating effects of this known carcinogen.
Elise Campaign of the Natural Resources Defense Council, the other rollback, the Bush administration's decision to use an obscure administrative procedure to allow logging, mining, and drilling on national land. Explain this, please.
Well, there's been a number of decisions recently, but the first came with a statement from the president that in the desire to open up many new public lands, not just the Arctic Refuge, to drilling, but to even consider drilling in our national monuments. That came as a real sign that the well-documented ties to oil and fossil fuel lobbyists by both the president and many people in the administration. Again, there's a question as to what the relationship is between these major campaign contributors and the policies going forward. The administration also has refused to defend this very important protection for wild forests that was recently put in place. It was 2 years in the making, had overwhelming public support, 640 public hearings, over 1.5 million comments from the public, and the administration caved to the timber industry's request for a delay in the rule. This is being played out in the courts, but it's clear that the administration is not vigorously defending this important new rule.
Charlie Kuhn of the Heritage Foundation.
I would like to hear someone go to people who are experiencing blackouts and brownouts and tell them that we, the United States, should not have access to the resources that are on our public lands. The president stated during the campaign, as well as now, that the United States is experiencing an energy crisis. And the public lands have resources, and we need to have, wants to open up those to access for exploration and development. Now, having exploration and development and being environmentally sensitive or not mutually exclusive, technology has increased to the point where we can go in and we can have access to public lands without destroying the habitat and the animals, number one. Number two, the administration isn't talking about going into the public lands and just, you know, raping the land. We'd only go in where there are resources. So the going in and having access to the resources on the public lands is something that is needed for our energy crisis, for the citizens of the United States, and it can be done while maintaining the environment.
Arjun Makajani, final comment from the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research.
I'm shocked that a spokesperson of the Heritage Foundation, known for reputable research, would not know how our regulatory system works. The National Academy does not make standards. It makes recommendations and scientific analyses. The EPA makes the standards. The EPA considered 5 micrograms, 10 micrograms, 20 micrograms, and not only technically and for health, but also for economic analysis. And the economic analysis shows that once you decide to reduce arsenic in the water, all of the available technologies reduce arsenic by somewhere between 80 and 95%. So it actually, for a system, for a particular system, it doesn't make any difference in the cost, significant difference in the cost, whether you set a standard of 20 micrograms or 5 micrograms. Where the cost difference occurs is nationally, because the number of systems you cover will be greater if you set a standard at 5 micrograms compared to 10 or 20. So that small community system actually will not face different costs if the standard is relaxed. It'll just be the number of systems. Moreover, the EPA has said that for small systems, it can be regulated at the point of use so that the individual getting drinking water from and cooking water from the tap, it could be regulated at that point, which has to be overseen with some measurements and so on, so that the overall system cost could be reduced. There is no new science and no new information that's going to come out in the next few months. This rule wasn't supposed to be even implemented in terms of hardware on the ground for 3 to 5 years. There was enough time given. There were financial resources given. There is nothing to be gained from this suspension other than a notice to the country that industry interests are more important than environmental interests.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you all for being with us. Arjun Makajani, President of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, Charlie Kuhn of the Heritage Foundation, and Elise Campain, Legislative Director of the Natural Resources Defense Council. You can go to the website at webactive.com, where you can also hear Democracy Now!, and you'll see their contact information. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we head north to Vermont to find out about the sheep that are about to be killed there. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, very much looking forward to seeing listeners in California and Los Angeles, KPFK listeners, Friday night, tomorrow night at 7:30 at the First Baptist Church at 760 Southwest Moreland. That's the First Baptist Church at 7:30 on Friday night. As we head now north to Vermont, after years of dismissing suggestions that mad cow disease might threaten U.S. livestock, the U.S. Department of Agriculture is suing possibly flawed tests to justify killing two flocks of Vermont sheep. The government claims the sheep may harbor the disease that's killed more than 80 people in Britain, devastated the British beef industry, and spread to other European countries. Last July, the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, Dan Glickman, ordered the destruction of the Vermont flocks imported from Belgium in 1996, where they may have been exposed to feed contaminated with mad cow pathogens. The Vermont farmers fought back with reams of evidence and an unprecedented court challenge. But yesterday, time ran out for one flock of sheep, which was trucked to Iowa, to be killed by lethal injection. Today or tomorrow, USDA officials are expected momentarily at the small family farm of Linda and Larry Falaise. While the USDA describes the Vermont situation as, quote, a real danger to the national economy and a potential serious burden on interstate and foreign commerce, the farmers insist the sheep are healthy and have become scapegoats to a too cozy relationship between the powerful U.S. beef industry and the USDA. We're joined on the telephone right now by Linda Falaise, a Vermont sheep farmer. Well, I guess the most important question is, do your sheep have mad cow disease?
I would not hesitate to eat any of our sheep. I will not hesitate to eat any of the products that come from our sheep. And I am outraged that USDA is able to attack the American livestock industry and put all markets at jeopardy by accusing these sheep of having a disease which has never been known to exist in sheep anywhere in the world.
What is the situation on your farm right now? How many sheep do you have?
Right now we have 126 sheep, and the sheep are in the barn. They're fine. They're healthy. They're basically being photographed by news agencies from around the world, so everyone can see what the animals look like. They can see that the animals are healthy. And then we have the feed records from Belgium showing what their ancestors ate. All the ancestors are alive and healthy over in Europe. So there's absolutely no evidence of any sort of clinical disease or any sort of neurological disease here. There's no clinical symptoms. There's no test which can be backed up to say that there's a problem in any of the sheep.
John Dillon is also with us, staff reporter with the Times Argus Rutland Herald in Vermont. Why is the government acting to kill the sheep then?
Well, Amy, I think what the government is doing is exercising the precautionary principle, which is really interesting because it's basically saying in the absence of total scientific proof, we've got to act with utmost and extreme caution to protect public health. But as you know, and you just heard with the arsenic story, that's not what they're doing in other cases. So the question can be fairly asked, why is the government being so zealous in this case?
Explain what you mean by that, comparing the arsenic story to this.
Well, here the government's saying that the sheep pose an unknown but possible risk to the health of U.S. livestock and potentially to humans. With arsenic, you know, that's a known human poison, and we're probably going to weaken the standards. So, you know, it's an inconsistent application of precautionary principle.
Is the action by the USDA consistent with other efforts to balance the interests of government and industry?
I would say no. If you look at what they've done with these sheep versus what goes on in the feed mills that supplies grain and protein feed to cattle around the country, the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, which polices and oversees those feed mills, had to disclose in January that their inspections were lax, that indeed there were some cases where they hadn't inspected a number of mills, that there are many cases where they had mislabeled feed. You have to go back to the scenario that where mad cow spread in Europe and in England, and that came about through contaminated feed. Feed made from meat and bone meal from animals that were infected. In the U.S., that practice of feeding ruminants to ruminants, cows to cows or sheep to sheep, hasn't been allowed for several years, but there hasn't been the oversight to guarantee that it's not happening. That's what the FDA was forced to admit back in January. So I think you could say that there's not been as stringent controls on that end.
While we were not able to get Linda Detweiler on the phone of the USDA, she did speak yesterday in Vermont.
These sheep actually came in when we changed regulations to allow importation of sheep and goats to bring in new genetics in 1996, but they were brought in under strict monitoring conditions at that time. In 1998, we received an opinion from the European Union that it was likely that their sheep and goat population may have been exposed to feed contaminated with BSE, or commonly known as mad cow disease.
So that's what the USDA is sending. Linda Falaise, you insist that these sheep were fed only organic, non-rendered feed?
Yes, they were all fed vegetarian feed, and we have feed records. This was something, with my husband has a PhD, and we lived over in England. He was doing a postdoc at the University of Nottingham. The professor we were working with was advising the British Parliament and the European Commission on issues concerning cattle feeding stuff and things having to do with mad cow disease. So this was something we were very familiar with. When we selected the sheep, we asked all the sheep owners to certify that they had never fed meat and bone meal. We actually offended some of the shepherds because it was known over there that people would be crazy to even consider having meat and bone meal. And all the shepherds we worked with gave vegetarian feed, and most of them gave organic feed. And we were able to get statements from the feed mills and the Belgian Ministry of Agriculture certified that everything that was supplied in the records were true.
What information do you have that the USDA may know that your sheep are not contaminated? I mean, didn't they do
500 negative test results? The same four sheep using the same exact tissue that Rubenstein said showed a positive was tested by USDA a year prior.
Rubenstein is
the man who did the Western blot test that came up with a suspicious four test.
For the USDA.
Saying that four animals tested positive.
Mm-hmm.
And
you took this data to trial, is that right?
And yes, that's
unprecedented
correct.
Challenge in court.
Right. It was after the hearing that we actually received a phone call from a sheep farmer out in Michigan who told us that there was negative test results that we were unaware of to file a Freedom of Information Act and see what you find. I filed a Freedom of Information Act. In 10 days, I had a list of negative test results, including negative test results on those same animals USDA had been claiming were positive. USDA subsequently submitted a supplement to the record that went to the court record of 1,700 pages. Included in that were 500 negative test results, and there were three different tests which USDA did on the four animals which showed that there was absolutely nothing wrong with those animals.
Then John Dillon of the Times Argus Rutland Herald, why is the government doing this, and what role does the beef industry, the beef lobby, play?
Well, the government's doing it because they say that those feed mills that the Falaises have records from documenting that they were fed vegetarian food, the government says those same feed mills also processed the meat and bone meal, and there's a possibility that the records are wrong. There's a possibility that the production lines could have gotten crossed. So they're taking what they say is this utmost precautionary approach. As to the role of the beef industry, I haven't seen it directly, but certainly it's the largest agricultural export of the U.S. We need to, the government feels it needs to assure the safety of the beef industry. We've seen what happened in Europe. Beef sales dropped by over 30% after the mad cow scare this year or last year. And in the administrative record that the government compiled in the Falasis case, there are memos there that say, you know, we're concerned about the possibility of this damaging exports. Just the news that there may be mad cow or mad cow version in the States is worrying Asian markets. That was in a memo from the USDA.
Linda Falaise, what will happen when the USDA trucks come to take your flock of sheep?
Well, to be honest, I'm still praying that a miracle is going to happen and they're not going to come, and it's looking slimmer and slimmer every day. But there's absolutely nothing we can do to stop them. You know, they won't let us work with them with science. They won't follow anything scientifically. They would not allow this to go forward in court, so our legal rights have been thwarted. And now we're in a position where we have to stand there, allow them to take innocent animals that we know there's absolutely nothing wrong with. They say that they'll figure out what the animals are worth, and they'll pay us whatever they feel that the animals are worth. And that I just can't believe that they can get away with this. Linda Detweiler was on Good Morning America this morning and said that these sheep tested positive for mad cow disease. I sure hope that the National Cattlemen's Association does something to get her removed from her position, because that is really going to devastate the livestock industry. Like John said, just the fear of mad cow disease being in the United States was raising arrows and questions for Japan and Korea. And to have Linda Detweiler say that on national television, I think is really going to cause a lot of problems.
It's also yesterday at the news conference, though, she said the same thing that they said in court last summer, which is that they cannot say it's mad cow disease.
Right.
She said that it's they don't know whether it's mad cow or scrapie, which, as you know, Linda, is endemic in the sheep population, but your animals are in a scrapie-free program.
Right.
Are there demonstrations planned?
Yes. There's absolutely nothing that will interfere with USDA. There's nothing, you know, planned per se, but the amount of people that are showing up, even in the midst of the snowstorm we're having here, is incredible. And there's signs, and people have the right to freedom of speech, and we're not allowed to have any third parties come onto our property if they're not the media. That was another thing which was demanded by USDA. And so we are asking all the people to stay off the property, but people will be here with their signs. And, you know, just to witness history in the making, unfortunately.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you both for being with us. Linda Falaise, a Vermont sheep farmer, her herd is about to be taken by the USDA and killed. John Dillon, staff reporter for the Times Argus Rutland Herald in Vermont. And we come back from our break. We'll be joined by Lori Garrett, and we're going to look at the globalization of infectious disease. She's the author of Betrayal of Trust, The Collapse of Global Public Health. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, AIDS, an emerging disease, was the first human pandemic of the age of globalization. Scientists now fear that foot and mouth disease, also known as hoof and mouth, an ancient scourge, may be the first animal epidemic to sweep the world, spread by the flow of people and goods that crisscross the globe every day. The current foot-and-mouth outbreak began in England and quickly spread to France and Northern Ireland. Cases were confirmed yesterday in the Netherlands and today in Ireland. So far, the U.S. has seen no cases. But in a Newsday article, Lori Garrett wrote, "The specter of foot and mouth disease looms large over the U.S. livestock industry. Tens of thousands of animals would have to be destroyed, and no U.S. livestock or meat products could be exported even long after the last animal illness was observed." And because of the centralization of the meat industry, if foot and mouth enters the U.S., it might spread widely before symptoms are even noted. Countries without an outbreak have imposed import restrictions, and at least one nation, Argentina, lied about being foot and mouth free. Most countries with outbreaks have taken the draconian approach of slaughtering all suspect animals. English authorities have killed and burned at least 300,000 animals, while devastated farmers watch their livestock and livelihood go up in smoke. Dutch veterinarians are planning a more controversial approach, which is vaccination. Well, now we're joined by Lori Garrett. She is a Newsday reporter, Pulitzer Prize winner. Her latest book is Betrayal of Trust, The Collapse of Global Public Health. Can you put mad cow, foot and mouth disease, what we're seeing in Vermont, into the perspective of globalization, Lori?
Absolutely. We've created a global food supply. Every year, the percentage of our food that we eat in the United States that is imported from locations where normally those foods did not grow or those animals were not raised, in other words, places where they are not indigenous, increases, and the amount of food we're able to export overseas increases. When you buy food in the supermarket, you really rarely know where it came from, and this is especially true for processed foods. So we're seeing a kind of globalized sense of risk for both meat and produce. It really is a risk that cuts across whether you're an omnivore, a carnivore, or a vegetarian. As far as what the big take-home lesson is about foot and mouth, BSE or mad cow disease, I like to ask people to reflect historically for a moment and remember the famous Jack-in-the-Box E. coli 0157 incident in Seattle, Washington in the late 1980s. That was when all of a sudden children died of hemolytic uremia having consumed hamburger meat at a Jack in the Box. Jack in the Box took the blame, but it turned out the outbreak of this then brand new organism, never previously seen on planet Earth, had first occurred in Nevada, but the state of Nevada's public health system was so completely in disarray, had so fallen apart and been defunded, that no one there picked it up. No one noticed it. The kids just died, and it went unnoted. Now it turns out that we have exported this new disease all over the world. It originated in the United States cattle industry because of the way we process meat, which is to say that whole entire carcasses get shipped to hundreds of parts, chopped up, and then shipped to secondary locations, chopped again, and set to tertiary locations, so that a given pound of hamburger meat may actually have bits of cows from five or six states all smashed together. So it became impossible to trace origins and stop this outbreak, and we ended up globalizing it. And worse yet, we ended up growing other crops downstream of our cattle feed areas so that then crops absorbed the E. coli 0157, and we exported it and caused a massive epidemic in Japan about 4 or 5 years ago that was turned out to all be the result of daikon seed. You know, daikon is a sprout that's a staple in Japanese foods, eaten uncooked. It turned out the daikon seeds used to grow daikon in Japan all originated in Idaho, and the seeds were grown downstream of a cattle ranch and absorbed E. coli 0157. So that should have been the warning call to the whole world that the way we're dealing with the meat supply in particular and with the globalized cattle industry was dangerous, and that it was going to defy the capacity of public health to stop and track and surveil for disease. Now we have foot and mouth and BSE. I think each of these have two very different lessons and very different possible ways of slowing their epidemics. But in both cases, the economic potential of an outbreak in the United States, even a single proven case, is so extreme that the thinking is now running, you know, pell-mell in one direction, and public health is really on the sidelines.
Lori Garrett is a Newsday reporter, Pulitzer Prize winner, and author of several books, the latest, Betrayal of Trust, The Collapse of Global Public Health. Are the world's public health systems capable of coping with these threats?
Well, foot and mouth is not really a public health threat at all. It has no damaging effect on human beings. It is actually not even particularly damaging to the animals it infects normally, although it makes them economically a little less favorable in that the cows may produce slightly less milk, or the female animal, and the male animal may put on a little less bulk. So this is purely an economic disease that has absolutely nothing to do with public health. BSE, or any of the so-called prion diseases, BSE, scrapie, and so on, are public health threats and also huge political threats. And I think that when you look now at how the USDA is responding, it's important to reflect on how the United Kingdom government under John Major, the Tory government that preceded the current administration in the UK, responded. It was a serious denial, non-threat, we shall ignore it response, which is now thoroughly documented and available in some 500 pages of painstaking documentation on the Ministry of Health's website at in the UK. And what that all revealed was how bankrupt the Tories were in terms of their willingness to overwhelmingly balance economics in favor of a threat to human health. And they've taken it on the chin for that. The British people are deeply resentful of the Tory party for how they failed to respond to Mad Cow. They're lying, what is now thoroughly documented, cover up, and so on. I think our government, regardless of whether it were the current Republicans or the prior Democrats, would not like to get similarly labeled as having failed to respond or to have covered up in any way the potential for mad cow disease to have entered the United States and afflicted human beings. So I think there's a big political game here. And, of course, also, were mad cow to be identified in the United States, we would face some serious economic hardships from the outside as well, but not anything similar to what foot and mouth would do. Reason, as far as we know, there is no capacity to transmit directly from animal to animal the prions that cause mad cow. This has to require the intervention of idiotic human beings who feed to vegetarian animals meat from another animal. Without that intervention, there's no spread of the disease. But foot and mouth is highly contagious. The virus can actually has been recorded spreading as a distances in excess of 1,500 kilometers in the wind. It can be carried on steel implements, on clothing, on. In fact, it's very likely that we will face foot and mouth here in the United States eventually because we have globalized so much since the last real serious outbreak in the 1960s.
Lori Garrett, what about the stated missions of the U.S. Department of Agriculture? One is to promote industry, and two is to protect public health. Don't they conflict with each other?
Certainly they do. And the conflict is glaringly obvious when we look at the question of the use of growth promoters that are antibiotics in the feed industry and the animal livestock industry, where for about roughly every pound of antibiotics used for medicinal purposes to treat human beings, there are 10 pounds used in livestock industry for non-veterinary, non-medicinal purposes, but merely as growth promoters, usually presented in their feed. And we know that antibiotic resistance is, in fact, being bred in livestock and is transmissible to human beings, and we have an ever-escalating rate of drug resistance in our common household bacterial populations, each year claiming more lives in America, killing people, and not killing handfuls, but killing tens of thousands of people. and increasing our overall hospitalization costs because resistant strains are more expensive to treat, so that even for those who do survive, the time in hospital, the difficulty of treatment, and the potential long-lasting side effects are much more severe as soon as you go up a tier in resistance in the bacterial population.
Wait, can you explain killing tens of thousands of people?
Yeah, the CDC's rough estimates are that between 19 and 38,000 people died in 1998 of drug-resistant bacterial diseases in America. Most insiders believe that's a lowball estimate. And the number one place where people are acquiring these strains or where they're spreading is in the hospitals themselves. It's very difficult to contain them once they get into the hospital environment. But we know for a fact that some of them are arising on the farms, in the livestock industry, and in agriculture as a result of the use of antibiotics in those ecologies. And people are being exposed either through the consumption of food or originally because they are the farmers themselves using the products, and then they end up in a hospital or a community setting and spread the resistant bacteria to other human beings.
Lori Garrett with us talking about, well, putting the whole issue of infectious disease in a globalized context. What about how the U.S. deals with health versus Europe? You have the U.S. Talking about, and we were talking about in the first segment, with the rollback of public health protections, environmental protections, saying that their work is science-based. USDA calling Europe hysterical in its approach to food safety. How much does this have to do with trade issues?
Oh, it is so complicated. let's put it this way. There's no good guys in this game. I don't think that you could point to the European response and say it's necessarily superior or inferior to ours. It's just different. And one key reason for the difference is that Europe is going through the process and has been now for about 15 years of becoming a single government, of consolidating its regulatory process from Spain all the way up to the UK, and in doing so has broken down some of their internal protectionist barriers that made it very difficult to have transparency on information regarding public health threats that were arising from all industries, but we're talking about agriculture here, and that's obviously a key one where, you know, the cheesemakers of France would do everything possible to prevent cheese makers anywhere else in all of Europe from knowing anything about how they made their cheeses or what was in their cheeses or whether there were health threats or anything else. Well, they've been in the process of breaking that down and trying to consolidate, much as we did, more than a century ago in creating uniform USDA policies across all 50 states. And in doing so, a lot of questions have arisen in Europe as part of this process and actually reached the regulatory level that have not here at the same profound level. And in particular, the whole question of genetically modified foods, the use of antibiotics in feed and certain pesticide uses and so on. And, of course, in Europe they have the Green parties, which have very strong feelings about these issues and have played a big role in the regulatory designs. All of our rules are much older, and they're grounded in regulatory processes that precede the understanding of any of these problems or even the existence of these technologies. So our process is quite different. But I think all sides would have a hard time claiming that they have interest-free regulatory processes or scientific scrutiny of, that's driven by true data and a truly interest-free balance of risk for all sides of the equation.
Would you say, Lori Garrett, that our collective health is in a state of decline? I mean, so often the media's coverage is how, you know, we have advanced to quite a remarkable degree in dealing with diseases, that the whole, diseases have been wiped out that we haven't seen for decades in this country.
Well, first of all, globally, we are now seeing reversals in life expectancy on a rather profound scale. In some countries, in less than a decade's time, we've seen life expectancy decline by as much as a full decade. That would be in particular in sub-Saharan Africa and the former Soviet Union countries for very different reasons, but HIV is a key factor in that equation in sub-Saharan Africa. Here in the United States, we are witnessing two trends that might seem contradictory but are not occurring at the same time. The one is increased life expectancy with the society becoming an older and older society as far as the mean age of the population goes, and with many Americans expected who are currently in the baby boom generation to live well into their 90s, if not a full century. And that changes the priorities of health expenditure towards a very, very expensive health paradigm in which, in fact, the ability to add anything to life expectancy or to improve the quality of life in old age is quite limited. We don't really have technologies that make an enormous difference once you're 90 years old if everything you did prior to the age of 90 was destructive to your health and led to a deterioration slowly of various organ systems in your body. What we're seeing in the United States, therefore, is a skewing of resources so that we now spend about one out of every five health dollars on people who are in their final stage of life, literally the final month of life, in most cases having little impact whatsoever and certainly not saving those lives. And where we're not spending is way up front. You know, about 20% of all children under 12 in the United States have no health coverage. And we know from the Costa Rican example, and one of many that illustrates
this point. We just have 30 seconds.
That the spending very little money on children has more effect on the overall health of society than spending 100 times more on senior citizens.
Well, Lori Garrett, I want to thank you very much for being with us again. Her latest book is Betrayal of Trust, The Collapse of Global Public Health. She is a Pulitzer Prize winner and a reporter for Newsday. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And that does it for the program. If you'd like to email us, send us mail at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. Again, I'll be in Los Angeles tomorrow night speaking at the First Baptist Church with others at 760 Southwest Moreland at 7:30. Very much looking forward to meeting KPFK listeners. Democracy Now! Is produced by Terry Allen and Chris Abrams. Anthony Sloan is our engineer. Earl Maitland, our technical director, special thanks to Andrea Sears. Again, our email address is mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of you, our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!
I'm Mark Cooper, contributing editor of the